This is the Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency with information for IT professionals. For more information and to download other shows, visit ciaops.podbean.com. This is episode 29 with Alan Birchall and is brought to you by the Computer Information Agency. Visit us on the web at www.ciaops.com. Welcome along to another Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency. My name is Robert Crane, and for this episode, I'm joined by Alan Birchall. Alan, how are you going?
Hi, Robert. Good. Really good to be here.
Excellent. Thank you very much for giving us your time this evening. And as we always do on the Need to Know podcast, the first thing that we'll do is let the guest intro themselves. So if you want to give us a bit of a rundown of who you are and what you do, Alan, that'd be great.
Oh, great. Well, my name's Alan Birchall. What do I do? I'm a IT consultant for a fairly large multinational consulting firm. By night, I am the author in chief of the Group Policy Central webpage, which is a website I maintain to about all my adventures in group policy and how-to articles and lots of information there on group policy. That's grouppolicy.biz, if you didn't know the URL. I'm a husband and a father to three daughters. One of them is only 6 weeks old, so I'm a little bit tired at the moment. So hopefully I can speak in coherent sentences for you tonight. But other than that, I'm just an all-round IT geek, and I just love geeking out on computers and gaming and everything like that, but also the enterprise side of things is my day job as well.
I see. Okay. So, yeah, maintain secret hours at night. You wear your cape after hours, do you?
That's right. But, I can't. Oh, hang on. Did I just tell you my secret identity?
Don't worry. We'll edit that out later on. Okay. Don't worry. It's yours and mine secret. So I think what I'd like to start off with, which is probably a bit of a unique topic, I think, for the SMB, the smaller market, is the concept around group policy. You've mentioned it there. You're obviously highly skilled in it and work with enterprises. But, can you give us a general overview for those who may be listening, have no idea what group policy is, make them a bit more familiar with what it is and what the benefits are?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, group policy is obviously used a lot in enterprises. What it is basically is imagine the old days where you have Windows 3.1 or Windows 95 on your machines and you wanted to configure the desktop wallpaper a certain way and have a certain image. Well, users could always change that. Then, you might go around and visit every one of those machines individually and change it. But then eventually network admins were like, well, we really need a way to change this and not allow them to change the desktop wallpaper. And before Windows 2000, there was some kind of clunky ways you could do that with policy. But in Windows 2000, there was a new feature called group policy. And it basically gave IT administrators the ability to configure thousands of different settings and options in Windows and have it configured in a lockdown way. So that, users couldn't change these things. Now, I said it's used in an enterprise, but I also support my father-in-law's hardware store. They have five computers, and I've actually got group policy managing them. They have two point-of-sale machines, a couple of office machines, and one out the back in the warehouse. And I've actually configured and locked down their machines using group policy. So, their registers, literally computer registers running on Windows, have nothing but a start button and a single shortcut to run the point-of-sale software. So it's really any environment that has a domain controller, and if you're running a small business server and that has Active Directory, that's a domain controller. So if you have an Active Directory, you'll have group policy in there. You might not be using it or editing it, but sure enough, there will be some policies in there applying to your environment that you probably don't even know if you're running SBS. But like it says, it's a policy. I want to apply a certain policy to a set of machines because obviously, as the name suggests, a group of machines. So it's a great way to, configure your machines consistently and in a way that the users can't change.
So Is it correct in saying that group policy can apply to a physical machine as well as to a login to a user?
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, absolutely. So you have computers and computers have accounts and you can apply policies to those computers. A good example would be, you know, run this system service as, you know, system service X, a user account, you know, like I have a service on a machine that you want to run as a particular user. You could configure that. That's a machine setting. If you wanted to configure the users, say, you know, screensaver timeout from 15 minutes down to 5 minutes, that's a policy you apply to the user. That's not necessarily a setting that would apply to a computer because computers, of course, you know, by themselves just sit there. They really don't have that screensaver timeout or background wallpaper would be another example where, you know, you don't configure a background wallpaper for a computer, you configure it for the user account.
Is it also fair to say that it could be used, for example, to do things like pushing out updates, pushing out software, you know, actually doing, so rather than locking people out, I suppose not using it for evil, actually using it for good, as in, you know, making an administrator's job easier by having a central repository of files and installs and being able to, when a user logs in, to, you know, push all that stuff out to them?
Yeah, one of the things group policy can be used for is deploying software. Not so much software updates. If you wanted to deploy software updates, you have a couple options. You could use Windows Update, or if you had, say, more than a handful of machines, you might want to look at something like using WSUS or Windows Server Updates software, which is a product that Microsoft gives away for free that does patching. You actually configure the workstations using group policy to use WSUS. But group policy doesn't actually push out those updates. But for applications, like if you have a software package and it's an MSI package, or if it's packaged up, you can actually deploy it using group policy. Now, this the ability to deploy software in group policy is very basic. Microsoft have really put that feature in there in Windows 2000 days, and they really haven't done a lot since then. As a group policy expert, I contradict myself to say I love group policy, but usually the only caveat I say is except around deploying applications. Sometimes there's some very good cases to deploy applications using group policy. You obviously, if you don't have any other mechanism to deploy applications, it's usually your only way you can use. But there's just some problems with it, like you can only install applications usually when the computer reboots. So if you assign a machine to, say, get some software installed to it, you might think, oh, okay, the software's now deployed, but of course the user doesn't turn the machine off at night, and so they might go a couple of days before they actually get that software delivered to their machine. It's sometimes a lot better to look at other third-party products or even something like SCCM, and I think there's an SCCM light version. I can't remember the name off the top of my head. I'm not an SCCM expert.
Well, I suppose the next question I'm going to ask you is, what about Windows Intune? I mean, Windows Intune is obviously Microsoft's move to deploying updates and patches and software from the cloud, but it also has a limited set of policies at the moment. But obviously, it seems to be a play to move towards that SCOM, the system center model in the cloud. I mean, can you talk to that at all? Do you think that that's sort of the way it's going?
No, absolutely. That's an excellent point. Like Windows Intune is version 2 at the moment. You actually can install applications from the cloud. So you upload a copy of your program into the internet cloud portal, and then you can deliver it from the Microsoft from the cloud software. And there's other settings you can also configure, you know, configure your firewall, configure your antivirus, or make sure your antivirus is turned on, and configure your update settings using Intune. And that's to save yourself from having to have a full-blown infrastructure on site like SCCM, because the back-end infrastructure is just hosted by Microsoft. But, of course, you pay a monthly licensing fee per machine to enable that.
Yeah, I think, and again, I think the my take on that is obviously it's still too expensive at $10 or $11 a seat, but the big advantage that Microsoft provides is they give you, as part of that, a Windows 7 Enterprise license. That means that can be upgraded to obviously Windows 8 down the track. So that does make it a bit unique. And I think it seems to be that it's something to be used in conjunction with some of these other technologies, and it certainly is increasing at a rapid clip from what I can see. And if you are a Microsoft partner, you do get access to, I believe, 25 seats for free to evaluate it. So it's a great way to maintain and manage your family computers, which is something that I do with it. I find it to be very effective. So
I think if there's also an option, and I always caveat with I'm not a licensing person, but if you pay an extra dollar, I think you then get access to the MDOP.
That's correct.
Suite of products.
The deployment tools, basically, yeah.
Yeah, some stuff like AppV if you want to virtualize applications, which can be quite handy. And MedV if you've got that stubborn application that just doesn't run, but maybe you want to install it on a few more than just one or two computers using Windows XP mode. Maybe you need to install it on, maybe a group of computers, and MedV is definitely a product that could help you there, which is part of MDOP.
Cool. All right, so I think that, like I said, we've given people enough information or scared them away from group policy, at least.
Run away.
We will come back to it a little bit later on, so for those enthusiasts, don't tune out just yet. But what I've sort of tapped Alan here for as well is to speak, obviously, to Microsoft's new operating system that's due out, I believe, probably June, July timeframe, Windows 8. So obviously there's a Windows 8 consumer preview or consumer version, and also a server version. So some pretty big changes. Let's just look at the consumer version to start off with. Sort of, as a general technologist, what's your reaction to what you see with Windows 8?
Windows 8. You know what? It's kind of like a roller coaster ride with me at the moment. If I look at the product, and some days I look at it and go, "This is great. This is the best thing ever." And I don't know if you've seen it, but there is a video going around of some elderly man using Windows 8, and his son says, "Here's Windows 8. Use it." And he looks at it and he goes, "Okay, it's Windows 8. It looks like Windows 7. Hang on, where's the start button?" And he sits there for like a couple of minutes going, "Where's the start button?" And eventually makes some snide remark about, "Oh, well, they're trying to make me go to Apple Mac or something like that." But basically what they're trying to prove is that, Windows 8 without the start button, is very difficult to use, which is an interesting take. I certainly think there is some merit to, if you look at a Windows 8, I mean, let's face it, let's explain what the big difference is that Windows 8, at the moment, and it's only in consumer preview at the moment, and they've committed to releasing another preview of some sort at a later stage, and then finally the final bits. So it's still not baked, so to speak. But right now, it doesn't have a start button. So if you look at it, it looks very much like Windows 7 with no start button. And the other obvious big difference is, when you do press, that can easily, not having a start button can easily get around. You press something like the Windows key, it actually then takes you to your start screen, and you now have a full screen start menu. And to describe it for the people, obviously, if you haven't seen it, to describe it, it's basically a list of square and rectangular tiles. They're quite large. And it could be in a grid of 3, 4, 5, 6 rows, depending on how big your screen is. But basically, they've taken the traditional start menu, like when you click on the start button and go all programs, and they've made it a full screen experience. Now, this is extremely different. If anyone's ever used a Windows phone, the UI of the start menu is quite familiar, but if for someone who hasn't, this can look very different indeed.
I think the interesting thing is the consumer preview, obviously when I powered it up, went straight to the Metro interface, to these tiles interface. And I think it's a case of, again, if you come from the technology background and you're used to the start menu or the right mouse click and, those sort of things, you do tend to struggle. And I think that, obviously, the thinking is that it's wanting to be used as a tablet interface or a consistency across a tablet interface. But one of the interesting questions I've got is okay, let's except that it is going on the desktop and it comes up with a Metro interface.
Mm.
I'm not going to stick my finger on my LCD screen on my desk to move the icons, even if I could.
No, and, you know, ironically, a couple of years ago, I was on the touch bandwagon, and I actually bought myself a touch screen for my desktop computer, and I think it took me all of 2 minutes of using a touch screen on my desktop computer to realize that touch screens on a desktop computer or even a laptop, a traditional laptop, are really cumbersome to use because no one wants to stick their arms out at arm's length to touch a screen. If it's in your lap, very different. And so a lot of people have said, well, this is a tablet UI. That being said, having nice big squares that of your commonly used programs in front of you is really nice on the desktop. And at the end of the day, you still have a mouse. And it's a case of, well, I'll just click on the square or the tile of the program I want to run. And it's very easy to find. I mean, you can still just start typing the program you want to find. Like if you type notepad and you just type the word N-O-T or N-O-T-E, you'll get two applications, sticky notes and notepad, just as you could in Windows 7. So there's a lot of things that haven't changed, but they're just not as...
Here's what I would consider the $64,000 question. Is it change for change's sake?
Look, I think Microsoft did a few blog posts about the start menu. And for everyone knows what the start menu looks like. I mean, you click on start basically and you go to all programs and then you've got this tree view of programs that are installed on your computer. Well, Microsoft could actually see in Windows 7, there's this program where you can opt in to send some anonymous data back to Microsoft. And so they can actually see in Windows 7 that people weren't even using the start menu. And of course, if you've got a large number of programs installed on your machine, sometimes you just want to easily find that program. And not everyone knows that they can just click on the start button and just start typing. So they need a way to really allow users to quickly find those programs that are installed on their machine. And having to click through a tree folder structure, I'm like, okay, where's this program? Okay, I'm looking for Word. Okay, I'm going to go click on program, all programs, accessories. No, it's not under there. Hang on, I've got to go back up a tree where do I find Word? Is it under Office or it could be under Office? Yeah. Oh, hang on, there it is. And so going in and out of a tree menu, you know, how many times have you used your mouse cursor on a tree menu? You've moved your mouse cursor up to the next level and you've missed and then the tree disappears and you have to click back again and go navigate the tree again. And it's just a feature that, as familiar as it is not a feature that's used. So how do you make those apps more discoverable? And that's really what they're trying to address. Now, of course, and they've said this, it's a very touch-friendly way of doing this. But if you have a look at a traditional computer, it's very easy now to quickly see your main programs that you've got installed on your machine in a tile format, and you can group them together, like you can, but you can even group things like websites together, which you couldn't easily do before. It gives that extra functionality. Now they could have left it the same, people would argue, why don't you just bring the start menu back? And it's like, well. Yeah, I think they've done it for the right reasons, which is the start menu is over 15 years old and people weren't using it. So if they weren't using it, obviously, for most people, then obviously there's something about the usability of that that's not quite right. How can we get people using the machine, finding the programs installed on the machine a lot easier?
So I was going to say part of it probably is also is you know, as IT people, we look at it in a familiar zone. But, you know, you would think or you would hope that Microsoft have people that actually pay money to sit down and watch how users use computers and think about, well, this may be used today, but what about tomorrow or how does this change? So, you know, look, they are obviously, there is probably an army of people. There's no guarantee that they will obviously get it right. So, again, I think part of it is it's like, the way I like to perhaps equate it is that when you change from, say, Office 2003 to 2007 and 2010 with the ribbon, the first week it just drives you nuts. You know, you can't handle it. But then after that, you begin to see the benefit. You begin to see how it exposes things, and it is a much better. So part of it is you won't know the benefit until you're exposed to it. Probably is part of the, you know, is part of the thinking as well.
Yeah, but that's not to discount also the desktop. I mean, they haven't thrown away the Windows desktop. And, you know, as of Windows 7, you used to be able to pin your programs to the taskbar. And I actually find myself, you know, almost all the time still running in desktop mode. Now, admittedly, that could be because a lot of the these new types of applications that are coming, these new full-screen apps that are coming with Windows 8, the Metro-style apps, there's only a limited selection of apps in the App Store at the moment. I mean, that's another big thing with Windows 8, is it going to have an App Store where Windows 7 didn't. But, I mean, you need an App Store going forward because, you know, and this also goes to a bit towards, well, why change the start menu? It's like, it's pretty clear in the industry that there's this big focus change to going to tablet and slate devices. And certainly now, right now, you say, well, how many iPads are sold compared to the number of computers? They're still insignificant. I think it's on the order of less than still 5% of the number of iPads sold, based on the number of computers sold at the same time. But it's definitely a trend that you can see is changing. You know, iPads, I think, have popularized the form factor. And Microsoft have gone, right, well, you know, this is, you know, the writing's on the wall. We have to either adapt or die here. And so this is also part of the reason why they've gone to this start menu style of screen rather than just a pokey pokey little all programs menu, which wouldn't work very well on a tablet at all.
True. Okay, so let's look at this, you know, pragmatically in the real world. You know, you're going to have your consumer who typically buys a new PC, gets the Windows 8, comes up with a nice Metro interface. That's fine. That's obviously who the consumer preview is talking to at this point in time. But that would be very much the minority, the vast majority of users that Microsoft is aiming at and makes all its profit out of generally would be the enterprise user. So, you know, if you were to apply the Windows 8 Metro interface across an enterprise, I would suggest to you that the very first thing they're going to do is to use your beloved group policy to somehow turn all that stuff off.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's a really good one, because one of the first days that I got my hand on the consumer preview, I actually found a group policy that said start Windows and have it directly go into the Metro style have it go directly into desktop mode rather than the Metro style. Unfortunately, in this fine print on this, and this is, I was a little bit disappointed about it, there's a fine print on that that says this will only apply to Windows Server. Specifically, obviously, it's intended for Windows Server running in a VDI environment or a remote desktop / Citrix environment. So really aimed at the server OS installs, but the installs that are used for terminal services, RDP, VDI, those, you know, thin client machines. So unfortunately, even with group policy, it's pretty difficult job to actually have it go straight to the desktop. That being said, as soon as the user's in the desktop, they stay in the desktop. They only go back to the start menu when they want to either run a Metro app or want to run another program. And if you turn your machine off, which by the way happens extremely quickly turning off, and it's even faster turning on, you'll get, if you put it to, like, into a sleep mode, you'll come back to where you left off. So generally speaking, you know, if you've already started the machine, it's not that bad. You'll stay in your desktop environment. Unfortunately, this is really a case of Microsoft are going to just force even enterprises to have to deal with this Metro style interface. So, which obviously has a lot of controversy around it, because even like I said, that's something that I was a little bit disappointed that you don't even get that option to kind of change your default to the desktop. But Microsoft are laser, it's really obvious that they're laser focused on making sure that as many people as possible experience this new start menu. And if you have seen it, it's very familiar look and feel across all the other Microsoft products. So they're obviously trying very hard here to get people familiar with the Metro start menu. And then they go to the Xbox and they go, oh, this looks exactly the same. Or then they might go into a shop and see a Windows phone and go, oh, this looks exactly the same as my Windows PC. That's great. I know how to use that. They're really trying to get that commonality across all their products.
It's interesting. I think that it would seem to me that in some ways, perhaps, it would be a counter to the, you know, one of their major competitors being Google, because one of the criticisms at the moment you could probably make of Google, which they are improving very slowly, is the interface. Gmail looks different to Google Plus, looks different to Analytics, looks different to all the, you know, all, because they've typically bought those companies and, you know, they're worried about the data, not the front end. Whereas if you look at the Microsoft apps now, the whole suite seems to be moving towards, you know, a consistent interface from the desktop all the way up to the cloud application. So, you know, maybe there is method in that sort of madness.
No, certainly Google are getting better. Like, but it's very interesting that the new look and feel of some of the Google products, and I occasionally use some of them, are looking very Metro stylish in that they're very simple text laid out in lots of white space in grids and icons and block colors, not fancy logos or anything like that. Very simple. And if someone is struggling to understand why they're going back to this simple text and square blocks approach, all I say is that when you're driving in the Metro, is look at some real world examples, and this is where they got their inspiration. Driving on the road, what does a stop sign look like? It's just a red sign with the word stop in it. And you only need to glance at it for a brief millisecond to realize that's a stop sign. If it had lots of pretty pictures and graphics around it, and it was different colors wherever you went, you'd have to sit and maybe look at it for a second or two and process what does that mean, and then go, oh, it's a stop sign, by which time you've already probably driven through the stop sign. They're just really trying to keep things simple and presenting simple and almost sparse ideas to the user, because it's easy to understand when there's not a lot of guff to basically confuse the picture.
So again, with that in mind, one of the other things they've done with the versions. So now they seem to have gone back to a consumer version and a professional version.
Thank God. That's all I have to say to that. I mean, Windows Vista was terrible, wasn't it? They had, I don't know how many different versions in Windows Vista. But then they had, if you go down the business track, you don't get Media Center. But if you go down the consumer track, you get Media Center, but you can't domain join.
The interesting thing is my understanding is that Media Center is still an add-on to the professional version only now. It's and to an extent, it seems to me that Microsoft's killing it off, but that's a side note. But you're right, the simplicity of it is that, you know, there's a lot to be said for that, and the different features and what the basic, I mean, my understanding is really one you can join to a domain, one you can't, and one has some more business features, but at the crux of it, that's what it is.
Yeah, so domain join is obviously a big one, and with domain join you actually get group policy support, which is obviously what I love to use. One of the other things you get with it is BitLocker. I mean, if you might have heard that in Windows 7, so you can encrypt those USB sticks. And Hyper-V now comes in the client. So I don't know, obviously you've probably heard of VMware or virtual machines. Well, Microsoft had a product called Virtual PC, which was a pretty lightweight product, but you could use it to virtualize, say, another copy of Windows 7 within Windows 7. But now they're actually putting Hyper-V in there. So you can run up a full-blown server, probably more for testing environment, more for testing purposes is what you use it for. But you can now run that up within your copy of Windows 8 using Hyper-V. And then and that's completely compatible then with your server. So you could be working on a server on your machine. You could copy it across the network and have it then run on your Hyper-V server. And then the other one is remote desktop, so the ability to RDP to your own workstation and run it as if, you know, remotely, as if you're connected in person. Those two SKUs, though, there's not really, I've called it a, there's probably more like a 3+1 SKU. There is also an enterprise version, which they haven't really, well, they have talked about.
The one that's available through Software Assurance.
Yeah, and they are for people with Software Assurance. So, you know, you are probably talking at the higher end of town if you qualify for Software Assurance. And that gives you a few more features with the enterprise version, stuff like App Locker, the ability to control what programs can run in your environment. But the plus one that I refer to is they've now announced Windows on ARM, or what they're calling now Windows RT, which I believe stands for Windows Runtime, although I don't think they've specifically said it's RT for runtime. But basically, Windows RT is going to be Windows running on an ARM device. Now, if you don't know the difference, obviously you've probably heard of Intel processors and their x86/64 processors, and that's since Windows 2000 the only thing that Windows would run on. They're now bringing back a new processor that will run on it, which is ARM-based. The good thing about ARM-based processors is that they're a very low power, but they're a low power processor. So it's obviously, it's what's in the iPad, it's what's in iPhones and a lot of your smartphones nowadays. And it has excellent battery life, but they're a very fit-for-purpose processor. You're not necessarily going to have as much raw grunt as a desktop computer processor, but you are going to have, you know, graphics acceleration. You're going to have a little bit of the processor dedicated to playing your audio and your music. You have a little bit of the processor dedicated to doing specific memory calculations or mathematical calculations. It's a very specific fit for purpose, but you know, it's also allows you to very quickly turn on and turn off these devices. For a Windows RT device, it's going to be you press the power button, the machine's off. No, not even a 2-second delay. It's just going to be off, and you press the power button again, it'll be on.
I think my understanding too is that Windows RT, or WOA as it used to be called, but Windows RT, is also going to include a version of Office for free.
That is another big feature of Windows RT. They have said it will include Microsoft Office, which is Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and OneNote. And so that'll be, they haven't really detailed if that'll be a full version of Office. I don't know. Hopefully it is. But even so, you know, the ability to author those documents on a device, basically like an iPad, with full keyboard and mouse support, because these Windows RT devices may look like an iPad, but you will be able to plug in a USB keyboard or a USB mouse into these devices, or Bluetooth or something like that, and you'll have no problems. You are going to be able to plug in a USB memory stick with your files on it and edit those documents, which you can't do on a device like an iPad. Which is some really big advantages over those other devices.
I wouldn't say you can't. I'd say you can't do easily, perhaps.
Well, I find the iPad with a keyboard, you can author a document, but it's the same thing with if you have a desktop computer with a touchscreen. Say if you wanted to select a body of text and you wanted to cut that text and put it somewhere else, you, again, have to reach your arm out, touch the iPad, very clunky. Yeah, it's definitely harder. I totally agree.
I think it's what I find most interesting is about, you know, I mean, the iPad at this stage, but potentially the touch stuff is when you talk to people, end users, I want to be able to, you know, do Word and Excel and PowerPoint. And then if you give it to them, actually watch them use it. Oh, I can't use this. I'll have to go back to my normal computer. Again, it's a case of, you know, you probably really aren't going to do that. It's good for viewing and making the, you know, the odd spelling correction,
yeah,
things like that. But, you know, constant authoring is probably not what these devices are for. But it, again, it's interesting that that seems to be a major criteria that the manufacturers would go, oh, yes, you can author full documents and do all that sort of stuff. Well, you know, probably only 10% of people are going to do that. But
But these Windows RT devices, I mean, Office is going to look like Office, as same as on the desktop. It's going to look exactly the same. It's going to behave exactly the same. And so you will be able to use Word as simply and as easily in Windows RT as you are going to be able to, say, in Windows 8. A lot of people commented that also, too, on Windows RT doesn't have – it's not Windows 8 RT. It's just Windows RT.
Mm.
So there's a lot of theorization going on. I don't know if it's true or not, that maybe in the future there'll be more frequent software updates or feature updates, I suppose you could call them, to these devices.
Well, I would also contend that perhaps it's a bit like, you know, iPad 2, iPad 3 is not called iPad 3, it's called iPad.
The iPad, yeah.
Or the new iPad, or is it, you know, and again, I think it seems to be as again, you know, you have an iPod. You know, I mean, there's all these different models, shapes, colors, features, but it's an iPod. So again, exactly. I think the reality seems to be is that we've moved past, you know, dual core, multi core, you know, all this sort of stuff. It, you know, it's a PC, it's a tablet, or it's a smartphone. You know, it's again trying to simplify things as much as possible, and it maybe signifies that people aren't as you know, wedded to that specific technology. It's really a case of, well, what functions do I really need?
Yeah, but I think this is the advantage that Microsoft are going to have in a Windows RT tablet form factor, is that it's going to give them the tablet tick, and it's going to give them a high level of functionality of a computer. I'm going to have my traditional desktop. I'm going to have my Windows that I can move around, Internet Explorer. I'm going to have my File Explorer, Windows Explorer, to look through the file system. And it's going to be a very strong tablet OS, and then it's going to be a fairly good computer OS. You're not going to be able to run the older applications, any Intel-based applications on the machine, at least they haven't said anything about running older machines. I think they've come out and said, no, we're not going to allow you to run older Windows applications on Windows RT. They have to be Windows RT specific applications. But it's still going to be a very powerful solution, I think, and it'd be a very good companion device.
All right, so let's again put our enterprise caps on here and say, right, you know, you go to a small business owner or any business owner and say, look, these WinRT tablets are going to do the job. They'll do Excel, they'll do Word, and you can, you know, da, da. And the next question they're going to say to you is, well, how do I control them? How do I lock them down?
Yes.
Now, you know what the answer is, but the logical thing would be to say, oh, well, Windows group policy, can we, because we can't really with those iPads, is that possible?
With group policy, no. And that's a bit of a shame, because one of the things to remember about Windows RT is that they're not domain joinable. But before you start going on, well, that was terrible, they do give you management of these machines. They've just recently announced that these Windows on ARM or Windows RT devices will have the ability for you to connect up one of these machines to your corporate network in a way that allows the corporate network to see your machine and deploy applications to those machines and also inventory them to see what they have installed and even configure some security policy settings like password needs to be enabled, or the minimum password length has to be at least 8 characters, or the device needs to be encrypted and its antivirus must be turned on. A lot like Windows Intune policies, actually. I don't know, and they haven't announced if there's any ability to connect these devices to Windows Intune, but you'd think it'd be a fairly safe assumption that they would. But basically, you will be able to connect these machines up to some sort of a management point, one they haven't really detailed yet, but a management point which will allow you to deliver apps, Metro-style apps, apps produced by independent software vendors, or shortcuts to websites, or even a link to an app store that is run by your business. So say, for example, you have your own app catalog internally in your business, like one's some HR apps, or maybe there's some finance apps. You can actually get them and link them to your own internal app store. So you don't have to then submit your apps to Microsoft and have them on the Microsoft App Store. You basically host your own App Store and publish to these devices. The other thing about these devices for enterprise is, I mentioned before, VDI, remote desktop or terminal services. These are going to be an excellent, excellent device to be used as thin clients. You'll have a remote desktop connection client installed in the machine, and you're going to be able to RDP to or terminal serve to your thin client or your virtualized back-end virtual desktop environment. And these would be excellent machines to do that as well. On top of that, when you're talking enterprise, every single Windows RT device must be an encrypted device. So they'll even, all of them will have hardware chips on them to ensure that the contents on the machines are encrypted, so that if a device gets stolen, they're not going to be able to, say, plug it into another machine and try to siphon off all the data. And you'll have all that management where you can, you know, do a remotely disconnect the machines. Oh, the machine's been stolen, you know, and someone's tried the password 8 times. Well, what happens after you've tried the password 8 times or X number of times? The machine locks, doesn't wipe, it just locks and goes, you need to put in a recovery key now, you know. So, you know, otherwise, you know, I'm not going to unlock. And the advantage of that is, obviously, if my daughter grabs hold of my work tablet, types her password in 6 times, 8 times, and locks my machine, I haven't just lost everything that's installed on my, or that's saved to my device.
Mm.
But I can get it back. So for an organization or a company, they have a lot, high level of confidence that the data on these devices are very secure. In that, and so it's very difficult, you know, if there's a lost device, it's going to be an extremely difficult process to get any data off those machines at all, which is a big important, like if you've got some really sensitive information. So there are definitely some big advantages with those Windows on ARM devices.
And are there any in the wild as yet?
No, none. And I don't think you're going to see these devices until day and day of the release of Windows 8. I really don't know. No one knows for sure. I suppose people at Microsoft would obviously have to know. But I think, and this is just a prediction of myself, I think what you'll see is that come the day Windows 8 launches, you'll also have a lot of tablet devices being launched at places like JB Hi-Fi, Harvey Norman, places like that, and there'll be retail launches of those devices at the same time, I suspect. But right now, no one has been able to get any of these. There's only been a very few videos published by Microsoft. But what you do see looks exactly like Windows 8. And that is, you know, again, one of the really big things. These are iPad-like devices with the great battery life, but they look and act, well, they certainly look exactly like a Windows 8 laptop or Windows 8 device will.
But, sorry, they are restricted to Metro-style apps, aren't they?
Other than the Office apps and, you know, something like Internet Explorer or Windows File Manager and, you know, what you can just do out of the box with Windows, yes, they're restricted to Metro-style apps.
I mean, obviously, there'll be more hopefully coming down the track. But, I mean, you know, again, it's got to start somewhere. And I think there's a big demand or big market for, you know, a decent Windows-based tablet. So, interesting that it's come out at the same. It makes sense. And, I mean, you know, you can probably see the benefits.
I think these devices will be, for some people will be their only Windows device maybe, but then they might find it a little bit restrictive, like if you had an iPad, you know, there's some things you can't do with iPads. But I think more likely it'll be, you'll have a Windows laptop or Windows 8 desktop, Windows 8 laptop, and you have a Windows 8 companion device, and there'll be a lot of cloud synchronization between the two. Right. And that's one of the big things with Windows 8, which is really nice. All your settings that you save within Windows, such as, you know, how you want to configure colors and screensavers and background images, it all just gets synchronized in the background now by the cloud that Microsoft hosts.
It's also the fact you log in with your Windows Live ID and it picks up your, you know, your Facebook connections and your photos.
Absolutely.
And you know, all that sort of stuff automatically. And
mm.
and you know, and again, if they can do that on Huawei, and I think that, and I mean, that is an advantage of the Windows Phone. It does the same sort of thing. You punch in your, you know, that sort of stuff, and it rolls it down. So, you know, again, it's an identity based thing, and again, that makes it easy for a lot of people. And it'd be interesting to see how that rolls out to the enterprise, because if you could sort of achieve that seamlessly. It'd certainly be a huge take up of the devices.
Yeah, not sure on that. There is definitely some group policies around that to kind of insulate those settings from enterprises to home users. Like, there might be some examples where enterprises go, well, we don't want their home user settings coming across, and you can actually block the synchronization of those settings. So it is configurable. There are certainly some caveats, some allowances there for enterprises to configure that. But yeah, definitely in an enterprise environment, to have that sort of stuff synchronized somewhere would be great, because then it's just like, oh, you need a new computer, here it is, just log on and everything will just deliver to it, and the user wouldn't even know it's a different machine.
Well, I think that, you know, again, you know, we've talked about the consumer side, the front end, the desktop end. I mean, obviously there's also a server version coming, Windows 8 server. I mean, what are the big advantages of the server from what you've seen?
Yeah, look, there's a long list of new features in Windows Server 8. I think if you look at the feature list in Windows Server 8, actually it's now called Windows Server 2012. That's the new official name. Windows Server 2012. So although I've said Windows Server 8 so many times, it's a bad habit to get out of. But certainly a lot of advantages around storage. They're now introducing a new feature called Storage Groups, which is, to describe it, is saying it's a lot like software RAIDs, but this is more of a let's deal with our storage with a different set of hard drives. They might be different capacities. Let's just aggregate them all together, and then we'll create volumes of different types on that group of hard drives, and basically make it a lot easier to set up redundant storage. But one of the advantages too with the storage on the file server is they've now introduced single instance storage. So as you know Joe Blow sends a email to six users, and those six users, hey, that's a great image attachment, I'm going to save that to my network hard drive, and now they've got six copies of that file floating around. Single instance storage on Windows Server 2012 means that you only have to keep a copy of that file once, obviously doing great benefits in saving disk space. Microsoft are saying in their tests so far that they're halving the disk space utilization on file servers just by removing all the duplicate data on those file servers. And for virtual machines, like let's say if you're running Hyper-V, you can run Hyper-V with VHD files, or now VHDX files. If you store those on a file server, which you can now do, which is a nice new feature of Hyper-V, just save the hard drives to a network share somewhere, you're getting like a 12-to-1, I think it was the numbers they were quoting, saving in disk space, which is just amazing, because these VHD files are so duplicated. A lot of the contents in them, obviously it's the same version of Windows again and again and again. There's a lot of duplication of data in that. There's some also other great benefits around networking, you know.
And I've also heard about an online backup as well, cloud-based backup solution.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, for businesses that have any sort of data on their environment, they need to know that it's backed up and it's safe. And one of the new things is Windows Online Backup, which is just basically allows you now, instead of backing up to a tape drive or to a CD-ROM or another hard drive, allows you to back up to Microsoft-hosted cloud. So it basically does a full synchronization copy to begin with. So, you know, if you've got a terabyte of data to begin with, you have to synchronize that first terabyte of data. But after that, it just does incremental backups. So it just does what's different, and it backs it up to the cloud. And that way, if you lose a file anywhere, or you want to get that file back, you can now just recover that from the internet. There might be some privacy concerns around that, but Microsoft have been very deliberate to say, look, you know, when we do these backups, you have to type in this extremely long encryption key to set it up. And if you lose this encryption key, I mean, can't get that back, we don't have access to your data, only you do.
Yeah, so it's doing pre-internet encryption.
PI, pre-ingress.
Encryption, yeah. So it's encrypting it with your own key before it pumps it out along, which...
Absolutely.
And that's good. That's the reality, the way it all... And it's not, as I said, that difficult to do. And I suppose also the advantage is doing that is you can take advantage of also compression and you're removing the duplication and all that sort of thing. So interesting, a lot of benefits. So with that in mind, what... You know, where do you look to be the next release date? So obviously we're talking about another preview version, whatever. We're talking about is that going to be the final beta in inverted commas, and then there'll be an RTM, I mean, a release? Where do you see the date sort of stacking up as to when, you know, we can go out and actually plunk down some cash and actually get, you know, the final version?
Yeah, so consumer preview has been out for 7 weeks. I know that because it came out a week before my last daughter was born, which was 6 weeks ago. So we're 7 weeks into consumer preview. Normally these things, if history is anything to go by, is that once they release the beta, they'll wait 3 months. They'll drop the next release candidate. I don't know what they're going to call it. Maybe they'll call it some sort of near final release or near final candidate or something. I don't know. So that would put it in May, June timeframe. And then after that, I think it'll be probably, you're probably looking, if I had to make a bet, I think you'd be looking around August, September, certainly late August, early September, they'll probably finish the product. Now,
I think that probably the best indication is what event of Microsoft's is in that time frame. Obviously, you know, their OS Tech Ed, I think, is that around when their Tech Ed is internationally?
Yeah, US Tech Ed, I think.
And when, I know their partner conference is I think June, July. I think looking at the dates here, yeah, their Tech Ed's June 11 to 14. So
I just think June's going to be too early. I think June will be probably whatever that final preview is.
Yep.
I think it'd be highly likely they'll drop the final preview for June, because then they'll have something to talk about at TechEd.
Yep.
And I think as soon as that happens, you could pretty much set your watch to 3 months after that, they'll release it, or probably less than 3 months. And that's...
Sorry, go on.
Sorry. That's RTM, though.
And I think the thing I was going to say is we mustn't forget about the Christmas sale. So obviously, you know, that's part of the timing, is to get it out and have it available and have the OEMs get the desktops and the, you know, all that sort of stuff ready for the, you know, Christmas buying sort of spree. So it certainly would seem that it's going to be this year. Now, coupled with that, my understanding is that Office 15, whatever you want to call it, will also RTM in this calendar year as well.
I don't know about that. I mean,
very, very really, close to it.
Yeah, I think it'd be very close. The fact that Windows RT will have Office in it,
yeah, that's a good point,
is a good sign. Now, that might mean, though, that Windows RT could be delayed, but it could also mean that, you know, the release schedule of Office 15, whatever, let's say, just call it Office 2012, or well, I don't know what you want to call it. I don't think they'll call it 2013, although, you know, because of the connotations around 13. But but if they call it whatever they call it, it might mean that it's lockstep with Windows 8. But if you remember, Office 2010 was not lockstep with Windows 7. So they would have had to tighten up that release schedule. Certainly a lot. Maybe they're trying to, you know, release it at the same time. Maybe they're not. If they're not, I don't think it'll be the end of the world, although I don't know how they're going to manage that with Windows RT. But if they do, obviously it'll be great. You know, I can buy a new computer with with Office 2012 or whatever it's called, and Windows 8, it's going to be the latest and greatest, and I don't have to upgrade my version of Office again next year for the 2013 or whatever the next 20. Maybe they'll call it, if it gets released in 2013, they'll just jump it head a year and call it 2014. I'm sure they've done that before.
Yeah.
just to avoid 13 altogether, or maybe let's say 12.1.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like I said, we could call it something like maybe Windows Vista. No, we've used Windows Vista. Right? You know, we get moving away from that. We want to stay with numbers. They're safe. So I think that, you know, we could sit here waxing lyrical about Office and what's coming in the track with Windows 8, and we do need to be respectful of your time. So just for the last, before we wind everything up, I thought that we'd perhaps lean on your group policy experience here. And you know, for the techies that are out there listening, you know, can you give us a bit of heads up, a bit of a brief run through as to, you know, how can we troubleshoot this sort of stuff? I mean, what sort of stuff should we be doing? I mean, what are the basics? What are good references? What are good sources of information? And again, you know, if we get problems with group policy, what should we be doing?
Yeah, well, obviously, I always say my website's a great resource for lots of stuff about group policy and troubleshooting. But generally speaking, I mean, some of the new things in Windows 8 are really good. There's some new reporting in Windows 8 that actually looks at how long did your computer take to start running, and how long did each individual component take to run. Like, if it took you, 2 seconds to run the registry keys that applied by group policy, but it took you 5 minutes to run that script when your computer started up, then it allows you to troubleshoot, well, why is my computer taking a long time to start up, or why is group policy taking so long to apply? There's a lot of new features around reporting around, you know, how long it takes to apply group policy. There's also a few new reports around, you can test group policy objects and say, you know, well, has this, you know, if you're a big environment and you've got lots of domain controllers in your environment, you can say, well, has this group policy propagated to all my domain controllers in my environment? Or am I still waiting for those policies to push out? Which is a nice tool, because sometimes you would make a change to a policy and then you'd sit there twiddling your thumbs going, is it 90 minutes yet? Is it 2 hours yet? Is it 2 hours yet?
Are we there yet, Dad?
Yeah, exactly. Because you really didn't know. It could be anywhere between 5 minutes and 2 hours. Well, now you can actually check to see if that change is pushed out, which is a really nice feature. And another one I think is really nice, this is probably the big feature in group policy now, is that group policy would always run on a schedule. You know, it would run when you turn your computer on. It would run when you log on, but then it would run every 90 minutes with an offset. So it could be anywhere between 60, so let's say example, 60 minutes to 2 hours. And it would just be a schedule, and it would just regularly repeat. And if you wanted to push out a setting quicker than that regular schedule, you just couldn't do it. It would just, you just had to wait for that policy to for the machine to go, I need to check for a new policy. Is there a new policy? Now there's a great new feature that actually allows you to push out a group policy update to all your machines. So you literally just right-click on an OU in Group Policy Management Console, and you just go Group Policy Update, and you just go next, finish, and it just does it. And then within 10 minutes, all the group policies on all the machines that are currently turned on will have updated. So if you want to quickly push out a new setting, a new shortcut to the desktop, a new printer, or maybe you want to run a script on that machine to say, shut them all down because, you know, we've got power outage that night or something like that. You want to just really quickly do something to those machines. You now can do that. A little bit of setting up required, but, of course, you know, I've got details on how you can do that on my website at grippolicy.biz. And I've got a lot of posts on that website talking about how you can do all these new reporting and the new features in Windows 8. I mean, if you want to learn more information too, I mean, something I should also mention is I'm going to be, last year I ran Infrastructure Saturday, yep, which was a great event, which was like a one-day event on a Saturday, obviously, which had a lot of sessions talking about Microsoft technologies. I've scheduled it again this year, so I've got the schedule up now. I'm aiming for the 3rd of November this year, which is a Saturday again, of course. So I'm hoping a lot, when we're talking about release dates, that it's going to be released before the 3rd of November. I think it's a pretty safe bet that by the 3rd of November it will be out. And so that we can do a lot of talking about Windows 8, obviously, and Windows Server 2012. And so,
What's the URL for people to visit to obviously sign up and look at the info and make sure they're aware of what's going on there?
Yeah, go to infrastructuresaturday.com. That's easy. That's as easy as that. Website's up now. If you go there, you can actually register. Don't have any speakers. Don't have any content listed yet. But if it's like last year, we'll have some great speakers.
And this is the best time to do it because then you have no problems. It's only when you introduce all those other things that you get all these problems, isn't it? The event works really well when there's no speakers and no attendees, but anyway.
When there's no attendees, no sessions and no speakers, it's really easy.
That's right. The website's really easy to maintain and all that sort of stuff. But obviously, that you've got a fair swag of time up your sleeve to start doing that. But I did attend that last year. I think it is an excellent event, and there's a lot of great information. Also, a lot of switched on people there that are all coming and presenting. So yeah, recommend it certainly to all people who are able to make it. Definitely a worthwhile event.
Yeah. So that's based in Brisbane. I should mention that, although we did have people fly in to attend the event and fly in to actually speak at the event as well. But there's 193 days remaining until that event's on. So put that in your calendar, 3rd of November. It's a Saturday, so it's good to put these things in the calendar far ahead.
There's less time to that than there is for the support on Windows XP. So
just about.
Yeah, you can attend that first and then worry about fixing your XP and upgrading it to
Windows. Yeah, I tell you, I saw someone tweet the other day. It was 2 years until Windows XP is end of life. And then someone else said, if you haven't started planning your Windows upgrade yet, you're in trouble. You really are, because if you think about how long it would take to make sure that every single Windows XP in your organization is gone within the next 2 years, if it's longer than 2 years, then you're going to be running out of time.
Surely there's a group policy called Kill Windows XP, isn't there?
I wish there was. I mean, group policy will still work on Windows 2000 if you still have it, which is a bit sad.
Oh, well, it's got to start somewhere, you know. It's
got to die at some stage, but...
All right, well, we do need to be winding up here. Sure. I think that we'll obviously thank you very much for your time and
that's all right.
That everybody got something from it. The last thing, I suppose, that I'll ask you just to let everybody know is if they want to get in contact with you, what's the best way to obviously, you know, if they want some questions or they want some information or, you know, how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so I'm on the Twitter if you are inclined to use Twitter. I'm at Alan Burchell, which is A-L-A-N. B-U-R-C-H-I-L-L. If you go to my website, grouppolicy.biz, there's a contact form there, and that'll send me an email directly. Or I'm even on Facebook. So if you go to facebook.com/grouppolicy, easy one to remember, you'll see a list of all my group policy related articles there. So you could follow me there if you want to keep up to date with me there as well. But yeah, by all means, if you have any questions about group policy, I am more than happy to field questions. I can't promise that I'll always answer what these be able to answer your question, but I'll definitely give it a go. I don't mind people sending me questions at all, or if you have any questions or queries about group policy or any other tech related topics, I'll certainly give it my best go.
Excellent. Well, I'm sure that the people that will take advantage of that, and we do thank on behalf of everybody for the time that you've given us tonight to speak about all those topics, and I hope everybody's got some good information they can take away and use in their business and got value for that. And I thank Alan for doing that for us, and hopefully that as the Windows 8 moves down the pipeline and becomes a bit more solid and reaches RTM, that we will be able to ask him to come on again and speak about the specifics and how it actually gets up and running. So once again, Alan, thank you very much for your time.
That's okay. Thank you.
All right. Well, that's the end of another Need to Know podcast from the Computer Information Agency. Thank you very much for listening. This podcast has been brought to you by the SharePoint Operations Guide. For more information, visit www.wssops.com. To provide feedback on this podcast, visit www.ciaops.com/contact.